great to see you here. It's the beginning of a new six-week series. And what we're going to, the plan of what we're going to do is I want to introduce you to the fourth section. That's great. The fourth section of Derech Hashem. Now, this is totally standalone. What I really want to do, I want to use this section as a springboard to explain to you some of the depth behind mitzvah performance. One of the things I'm getting more involved with is speaking to young people, teenagers, school children, and the teachers of such people, is to try to discuss the depth of mitzvah performance. A lot of people seem to find mitzvahs very dry, very by rote, and pretty much meaningless. It's just ritual without meaning. And if it becomes ritual without meaning, it can sometimes, it's like, why am I doing this? What's the point of doing this? Why would anyone want to do this? What people don't understand is, if you remember, for those that were here for the section three, which is where we talked about theurgy, which is the spiritual manipulation through ritualistic behavior section, which is a bit spooky, all that kind of stuff. What we're learning out is that what we're doing is not for naught. Things that we do tap into certain energies at certain times. For instance, the Torah explains to us that Pesach should be in the springtime. So much so that we've got to organize a calendric cycle that has that happen. In fact, the first mitzvah which was given to the people of Israel was in order to establish a calendar. A very difficult thing to do if you think about it. Nobody had a set calendar like us until we were told to do it. Our calendric cycle is the most complicated calendar that exists anywhere. First of all, we use variable hours. So we take the amount of sunlight at whatever longitude and latitude we are physically, then divide that by 12 and make the minutes fit. So a minute can be as little as 48 seconds in the winter, as long as a minute and 10 seconds in the summer, to fit the whole 24 hours for 12 hours of light, 12 hours of darkness. Then what we do is we have a lunar calendar, which is modulated by the solar calendar. So we have both the lunar and the solar. The Ishmaelites, the Muslims, only have a lunar calendar, and the Christians only have a solar calendar. So Ramadan comes in a different month, year by year, and the Christians have a very fixed solar calendar. We have is the lunar calendar, which then has periods, four periods a year, set by the sun, known as Tekufos, known as periods that are set. So we have solstices and equinoxes. And those are very, very important. We set the sun, and so much so we'll insert leap months, like this year, into the year, in order to make sure that we maintain Pesach in the springtime. Now, why would we do that? We do that because Pesach has to be in the spring. There's something about springtime and the fact that you shouldn't be having leaven. Indeed, Avraham Avinu kept Pesach, even though he didn't have any kids, even though he didn't go down to Egypt, and even though they weren't released to bondage. Because frankly, it's beyond that. Whether or not he would have had kids, who would have gone down to Egypt or not, you'd still have to keep Pesach. Because he looked into nature and he realized now is the time to have matzahs. Indeed, when the three angels visited him, and Sarah, his wife, made cakes, those cakes are called ugois, which means egel, which we learn now matzahs. She was preparing matzahs, which is why we tend to have round matzahs, because the word for ugo, which is the cakes that she's making, is loshon egel, which means circle, and that's why matzahs should be circular. There is a fascinating concept as to why machine matzahs are square, which I'm very happy to discuss with you. In fact, the first machine matzahs that were made were round, because all matzahs, all Jewish matzahs, are round. So I'm just going to do it because, oh, why not? I'm just in the mood. So the Chassam Sofer came and banned machine matzahs in his day, saying that they were considered chometz. And the reason for that was, is that in the old days, they had very, very simple machines. We're talking like over 100 years ago when they started making round machine matzahs. What they used to do is have a strip of dough coming out of a sheen on a basic conveyor belt, right? And then what they used to do is have like a cookie cutter press. They used to come and press the circular circles out of the dough. And then they'd go through an oven and they'd box them up and you'd have yourself machine matzahs. Brilliant. Except the unscrupulous matzah makers would take the off cuts that were round the cookie cuts and chuck them back in the hopper and make a second batch. By that time, of course, it's gone past 18 minutes and everything's chometz. So you're basically having these machine baked matzahs, which are chometz. That's why Hasidim today hold that machine baked matzahs are chometz. You can't have them. The truth is today's machine matzahs are probably the most kosher matzahs you can get. They have hardly any shyness associated with them. It's the hand-baked matzahs, which they can have folds, a knetch or a koffel, which we're worried about maybe could have chometz. They're problematic, actually. The most kosher matzahs are going to be machine-baked matzahs. So why do we make them square? The idea to make them square is to be no offcuts they'll be chucked back into the machine and reused. Today, of course, we could extrude balls of dough, which could then be flattened with no offcuts whatsoever. But because the minhag is now to have square matzahs, square it is. So there you go. So the point now, the point behind this is that Avraham Avinu was eating all this, and his kids didn't go down to Egypt. So his Haggadah was very different. He didn't have a Haggadah. Understand? He understood that in nature, there's something to do with that particular time. So each particular mitzvah is associated with a particular thing in the universe. It's natural that the Jews would then come out of Egypt at that time. Of all times in the year, the only time that Hashem's going to take them out is at the time in Nisan. We were waiting until Nisan to come out because Nisan is a time of emancipation. Nisan is a time of birth. That's what Nisan is. Spring is a time when nature rebirths. So of course the birth of the Jewish people is going to happen universally at that time. It's the other way around. Don't think that we set Pesach because of what? Pesach was set because that's how it has been designed. When you understand mitzvahs like this, the depth and the meaning of the mitzvah just jumps into a whole new league. It just, you realize what you're doing is in tune with nature. Indeed, there's Naam L'Torah, Rav Zalman Sirotkin says in the beginning of Parshas Bechor Kosai, he says, when you keep Torah, you're keeping the natural order. When you break Torah, you're literally stepping outside the natural system that God created. It's an amazing concept. The more we learn here, the more we'll understand what this Naam L'Torah was originally saying. Okay? So with that, I'm going to jump into the text on page 251, which is the beginning of chapter 4. And he's called it Bechelkei HaAvodah, within these general areas of divine service. Yeah? Now, I'm just going to go through the text. I know that you don't have a spare text, but it's going to be very, very straightforward, okay? Are you ready to go? Are you comfortable, everyone, on the page? So on top of page 251.1, it's a one-sentence start. Serving God involves two elements. One is study, and one is observance. You can't study and then not really understand what you're studying without observing it. That's like learning a lot about exercise physiology and never exercising. So you've learned and learned and learned, but you never get any fitter, right? Because you don't go on the treadmill. And you can't observe without studying, because you'll never know how to observe. Both are dependent, right? Observances in themselves are divided into four categories. So if you have a pencil and you have the text, I'm going to ask you to make a little bit of notes here. Those that are number one, here's number one, continuous. You have a continuous, constant mitzvah. One of them is to believe in Hashem and constant. Or that's those that are performed once a day. Or if you put in number two now, a fixed number of times per day. Some are continuous, some come regularly per day. Then number three, those that are periodic. We're going to have a whole section on periodic observances, right? And that's like Pesach. And then there are those that are occasional, like only if you see a bolt of lightning, or circumstantial. In my circumstances, now that I've seen a bolt of lightning, there's something that I should do. In my circumstances, now that I want to slaughter a cattle, or something like that, then there are certain mitzvahs which come upon me as to how to do that. That does not mean you're under the mitzvah that you have to slaughter cattle, but if you're going to do it, then there are ways to do it. But if you go your whole life and they have to slaughter cattle, it's like, why didn't you do that? Isn't it right? Okay, let's talk about continuous observances. Let's talk about mitzvahs that are there a lot.
Can I ask you, just, you've asked us to put numbers in, but assume that the number one is those that are continuous and constant. Therefore, what happens to those that are performed once a day?
Or ones that are performed once a day or fixed times a day is two.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Those that are periodic is three. Okay. And those that are occasional or circumstantial are four.
Sorry.
Those are the four types of mitzvahs. We have no more mitzvahs apart from that. That's the four types. All mitzvahs fall into one of those four. So I'll just say that again for those taking notes. There's the continuous and constant is one. There are those which are done a fixed number of times a day or once a day or whatever. That's two. There are those that are periodic, which is three. Those that are occasional, circumstantial, depending upon where you are, who you are, if you're a man, if you're a woman, if you're a Cohen, if you're a Levi, and something happens to happen to you, that, oh, you got a slave, and he wants to leave, and then he wants to stay, and you happen to own the slave, and you're in Jerusalem, at a time when the temple stood, then you've got a mitzvah to put an awl through his ear, etc. But that only happens in that case. Let's look at continuous observances. Let's look at number one, continuous observances. These are those which are incumbent upon man at all times. Now, I already want to start. Yeah, if I just started this, you're like, I don't know what you're talking about yet. But I really want your ears to be piquant on this. If a mitzvah is continuous, it's obviously not so. It may be time bound, or it's almost above time. It's so key. It's so important. It's so psyche changing. The mitzvahs were given in order to draw you closer to Hashem and avoid evil. That's the only thing they were given for. They were designed to turn you to God's direction and make you more God conscious, more sensitive to God's will in any particular circumstance. Now, some particular circumstances will never happen to you ever in your life. For instance, if you never see a bird's nest on the way in an area which is completely ownerless, it's not someone else's property, and you want to take the chicks or the eggs, then there's no, you know, then there's no mitzvah to shoo away the mother bird. Which means that that's not a continuous mitzvah. It's not as if that's something which is absolutely key to turn you to God consciousness. The key is, if you wanted to take the chicks or the eggs from such a bird, the thing which would be most in tune with God consciousness is to at least prevent the mother from having such distress. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is, if this is something you've got to do at every moment in your life. So the ones that you do at every moment in your life are obviously very, very important. They're going to be constantly pushing you into God consciousness, right? So the frequency of a mitzvah, to a certain extent, shows its importance. And that's why, by the way, if we've got two mitzvahs that come to our hand at the same time, and we don't know which to do first, which should we do first? The one which is more regular, Todir. You say, Bori Todir, you always go with the Todir. You always go with what's more regular. Why? Mystically, it's because regular mitzvahs are more potent. When it comes to saying Kriya Shema or saying Sfira at night, both are derisa mitzvahs. If it's during the time of Sfira Sa'oma, you're not allowed to eat once night comes in, and you've got to count Sfira. But the same with Shema. So if you've got to do two, which are you going to do first? The Shema comes first because the Shema is every day, twice a day. So we learn out from that the Shema has more potency on your consciousness, on your psyche, than saying Sfira. So we say, do Shema first. If you're only going to do one, do the one that's more important. Do the one that's more important that comes to you. Do you want to say, is this making any sense?
You get that when you have two separate towers out, which when you've got Rav Shkodi.
Very good. The one that you use most has Hashivas. If you use that one every single week, that's the most important Sefer Torah you got. Because he's the one you're always using. You're getting close to Hashem with that one. That's right. Absolutely correct. Okay, let's continue. Continuous observances are those in which are incumbent upon man at all times, such as love and fear of God. Now, think about this. If mitzvahs are only designed, as we learned previously in section 1, or even on page 61, to turn you to God consciousness, clearly the concept of loving and fearing God is really, really, really important. In fact, that's actually what the mitzvahs are meant to do. They're meant to make you love and fear God. And we've got a mitzvah to love and fear God. We'll talk about what love and fear God means. We've got a whole chapter on what that means. Fear comes before love in any relationship. You cannot have proper love without fear. Fear here does not mean terror, although that's an intense form of fear. Remember, respect is a form of fear. It's within the fear camp. I respect you. I give you distance. I give you your space. I listen to what you're saying because I'm scared I might upset you. I'm scared you'll be upset. I give that respect is a form of fear. Respect must come first in a relationship. You can't have love without respect. You can have feelings of wanting to give, etc. But unless you have a mutual respect, if you have absolutely no respect for the object of what you love, then the love that you have is not a solid love. Mm-hmm. And that's why respect is more important than love. But love is a high level of relationship. If you're only going to have one in a relationship, have respect. If you've got a spouse or a brother or parent, if you're only going to have one emotion towards them, at least let it be respect. It'll be a good relationship. If you have love without respect, it'll collapse because the foundation won't. It's basically one of self-love rather than a true love, a giving love, right? If an individual works with special needs children or something like that, my wife works a lot with special needs children, stuff like that. Obviously, she ends up loving these kids that she works with for years and years, and you give a tremendous amount. But there's a tremendous respect of wanting to see them grow, doing that for themselves. You're doing it for them, as it were. You know, that's a tremendous act of love. Has to be done with respect. There has to be a mutual respect also with a child to the carer as well. If there's no respect, if they're violent or mean, it's very difficult to form that love relationship. So too with Hashem, the most important thing is at least a respect for the fact you created the entire universe and put you in it. right, where you've got no rights to say I should be there. Loving Hashem, we'll talk. It's very difficult to do that because we'll talk about that. But is this good so far? Yeah. So these are constant mitzvahs. These are mitzvahs which are just on you from the moment you know your eyes open until they shut. Yeah. Obviously, that's very, very important. That's number one. Let's look at number two. Number two is service, which is obligatory on a daily basis. It's sometimes required once, twice, a few times a day. Now, we are very out of tune with what Judaism really is. In fact, all of us have probably never really, well, at the moment, certainly I can say we've never kept real Judaism. Real Judaism isn't real Judaism without a Beis HaMikdash. Without a temple in Jerusalem, we simply don't have the focal point of so many of our mitzvahs. Indeed, I think I've talked, for those that have been here in previous sessions, that the difference between a Jew and a Gentile without a Beis HaMikdash, numbers-wise, is not very much, if anything at all. Between 240 and 160 mitzvahs without a temple. And for a Gentile, if you add up the seven mitzvahs they know as headings, there's between 160 and 240 mitzvahs for them as well. So for Jew and Gentile without a temple, it's very difficult. We've never had Pesach. We've only ever had a quasi-Pesach. Getting around a table. You're meant to be in the temple precinct eating a paschal lamb. You've got to have shawarma and four glasses of wine. It's a religious duty. Once a year, shawarma, four cups of wine, with good friends talking about old times. That's a religion I'll sign up to. Irrelevant to an honest tree, by the way. So everyone has to go to Jerusalem, have a shawarma, four cups of wine, and have a good old talk with his friends. I'm in. But that's actually what that place has to be. All night, right? We have this thing around a table where we lean ever so ladylike. That's not what it's about. You have to be in the temple, on the floor, eating everything of this land. You have to get together with enough people that you can totally bone the land. I mean, there's nothing left but the skeleton. You've got to do that. Shavuos, that we just had, right? That has to be in the temple. That has to be in the temple precinct. Three times a year, you've got to turn up to me. You can't turn up empty-handed. Everyone has to make it. Everyone has to go on pilgrimage. But without a central focus for that, we simply don't know what Judaism is. One of the things which is 100% cyclic is the daily offerings. The daily offerings was something that had to be performed, specifically the Korban Tomid, right? The inauguration offering, it kicked off all other offerings. You have to have an offering once a day. Every day, come what may. The temple could not function without a kickoff offering. It had to be like that. Even if it was a really quiet day in Mar Cheshvan, you had to have the Korban Tomid. So this is one of those mitzvahs which is obviously very, very important. Very, very important. The Korbanos were vital. We don't have the Korbanos today, so what do? We say, let your lips replace the bull, says Hashem. That's right. We have to learn in lieu of that. But we've got to do something, note. We can't just say, let's let it just slide. Right? So one thing is, the Korbanos were an example of a category where the temple stood. But today, when we don't have that, examples of daily observances are the recital of the Shema, which women also do, right? And prayer services, three times a day. Women tend not to do Maariv, but often women do Shacharis and Mincha. They don't have to, etc., but they could do that Mekabel Amalchus Shemaim. Okay, number three. Number three. Let's look at periodic observances.
Thank you.
Yep.
Does that suggest that all that has to be meaning that Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov and the matriarchs were not Jewish by that definition?
Well, we know that the matriarchs weren't Jewish.
No.
But they were Bnei Israel. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would set them aside as going to be the pillars of the genetic pool for Israel. But nobody was technically Jewish until the Mount Sinai experience. The Mount Sinai experience bound everyone into true Jewish practice and law. Remember, Shavuos night, we just had, I don't know if you did, but the night we had milchiks. I don't know about you, but we had milchiks. There's lots and lots of reasons. There's 10 reasons. Lots of reasons as to why we have milchiks. Hagav ninim, and it's gvina, and it's cheese, and milk and honey under your tongue. The Torah is considered like milk. And the mother nourishes and suckles the child with milk, and the Torah is like the nourishment that Hashem gives us, as it were, from himself. And lovely. But there's a practical thing. When the Jews got the Torah, they realized all their pots were treif.
Can we hold on?
Just to, I could check. They had to go and do Haggadah on their pots. Now, why then did they have milchiks? The answer is because milchiks, cold milchiks, is much easier to deal with than fleishiks. You have to start doing Haggadah on all the Kalim. So now that they'd learned that all their pots were treif, they couldn't have, they knew they had to shecht meat and salt it. They'd never learned all this before. Which means, technically, let's just think about this. It's really bizarre. For those individuals who know what a TARDIS is, do you know what a TARDIS is? The blue phone box that Doctor Who has. Is everyone up to speed? I'm sorry for this, going to go out on the tour-away side. For anyone, there's a character called Doctor Who. He has a blue telephone box. You can go in, he can move anywhere back and forth in time that he wants. Imagine you could take a TARDIS and go back to Avraham Avinu's house just on Pesach, just after the angels had left and told him that he's going to have a son. This is Avraham Avinu, one of, if not the greatest man that has ever or will ever live, basically. It's just as good as it gets. Him and Sarah were just basically it. Kodesh Baruch was like, right, you know, you can be like Adam and Rishon. Set it all up from you, right? So you get there, it says, you, the TARDIS turns up, and the doors open, and all of us from the ship start walking out, and there's Avraham Avinu, and there's our great-great-grandparents. And they're very happy, because the Melachim just told them they're going to have a kid, but Hashem, after all these years, it's very nice, he's happy. It's Pesach, by the way. It's Pesach, okay? So we get really through him. So we walk in, and we sit under his eshel, and, you know, the leaves come out, and it's all very nice. And Avraham Avinu, you know, comes up and starts offering us food. And we'll start to get nervous over the Heksha. So if you have a look, the little stamp, you know, on the packet says, you know, based in Sedek, you know, Rosh, you know, Avraham Avinu, Viriyose, and sorry, you know, of Sodom and local area. You're reading it and you go, oh, I'm sorry. What? This is Avraham Avinu's cooking! It's like, this is sorry, no, this house, you can't get better than that! It's not good. Not good enough for me. Can't eat that. How could you can't eat Avraham Avinu's house? I've got news for you. The first ever Seder, which was held in Mitzrayim, with Hashem going door to door, checking the lintels for the Paschal lamb blood, and going in and slaughtering those that weren't brave enough. You go to Moshe Rabbeinu's house. Walk in. Could you imagine that Seder? How he'd relate that? Then I went to Pharaoh. And I told him, I said, you've got to let him go. And if you don't believe me, you can ask your Uncle Aaron. And he wouldn't listen to me. And he got, could you imagine? It's him talking about it. If you sit around that table, you'll be able to eat. Can't have it. The next Pesach in the Midbar, Mahadrin. That's great. Because you've got a Shulchan Aruch. Judaism was set at Matan Torah. Prior to Matan Torah, they were not bound or obligated in mitzvah performance. But not like we did, not as accurately.
He know what all the mitzvahs were.
Not as accurately as we did, no. No, and if you went, as I'm saying, you went back in time to his house would not be considered kosher enough for you because you're bound by Shulchan Aruch and have far more stringent ways of doing things than he did. Now that doesn't mean that he was wrong. He was right to do what he did in that particular time. There was no Torah. Everything was voluntary. I think I've done this before. If two people do something, it's someone voluntarily looks after old people and someone is paid to look after old people, who is more rewardable?
Paid.
The one who's paid. And why is that? Right, the one who's paid immediately rescinds against it because they feel as if they have to do it. Once we were given the Shulchan Aruch, we got a special gate of horror not to do it. Avraham Avinu didn't have to keep Pesach. He wanted to do it because he genuinely wanted to get close to Hashem. But there's no, his Yetzer Hara not to do that. There's no Deraisa mitzvah for him to do it. You have a Deraisa, a scriptural mitzvah, to keep Pesach. So you'll have a special Yetzer Hara set aside for people that have to keep Pesach. It's a different kind of practice. You wouldn't have had the opportunity to keep Pesach if it wasn't for him. See, he gets the brownie points. It's a Ponzi scheme that works up to the others, and they're doing great, okay? It's fantastic. We're happy for them, yeah? But at the end of the day, they weren't bound like we are. They weren't bound by the tyrant. Your question about the milchik pots?
It was basically the same as Adrian. Right. I thought Avraham kept all mixed.
Yeah, yeah, he did, but not
why,
the way...
Why was it... So if you've got treif pots, how can you make them milk if you didn't know...
Kasher them.
So why could you not kasher them meeting?
But they... You could... You could, a vada you could. Once you kasher them, then they're parv. Then you can do what you want with them.
So was it just the shechting then that was the problem?
The whole meat production issue is a problem. Okay. It's a very complicated. It takes a while. I mean,
but we learned that they basically just were given the Ten Commandments and then went back to their tents after that.
No, but the Ten Commandments were headings, Clive.
Yeah, but how did they know all about what's kosher and everything?
Kosher, so it was all given over very, you can't understand, they learned all the subheadings with the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, but then
so they weren't just given that. They were given a whole bunch of data. One of the things they were given was kosher. By the way, the Medrash Rabba, I've got to share this with you. I think I may have said this, I'm not. The Medrash Rabba says in Shemois, Parsha Shemois, Medrash Rabba, Don't take my word for it. Check it out. This is Stunning Tyra. You know, God wanted to give more than 613 mitzvahs. There was more to give. But we ran away from Mount Sinai like a kid runs out of school when the bell rings. We were saturated. Had enough. Had enough of the day. Couldn't take it. Sure it does. He's infinite. There'll be infinite. No, I'm not going to argue with you. There are infinite ways. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense instantaneously because you haven't 43. Just wait. There are infinite ways to get through to Kodesh Baruch Hu. And the Kodesh Baruch Hu had many, many more methods of getting through to him had you were held on. Millions of mitzvahs if you want. There's always another way. As long as he gives it to you, there's always another way. But he's only 613. Let's go the other way around. What happens? You know, he offered the Torah to every other nation prior to us. And they all said, no thanks very much. What would have happened had the Jews have said, we like the Torah, but we don't like all of it. We'll keep it properly, but there are some mitzvahs we don't want to do. The Medrash Rabba says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is flexible. The Medrash Rabba, I'm not making this up, okay? The Medrash Rabba says Hashem was flexible, and we could have bargained him down. But there's certain mitzvahs wasn't willing to bend on. Deal's a deal. We never did this. But had we've got round the table and said, listen, we want the Torah, there's a lot riding on it, all of creation is riding on this. We know that if we don't accept the Torah, you'll have to fold creation and start again, because there'll be no justification in keeping it going. And the whole mountain will be hallowed. Hashem says, you know, either you're going to take it on, I'm going to kill it kind of thing. This is it. Birds didn't tweet, the waves didn't go in the ocean. Everything was waiting for justification at that moment. How did you say, listen, we'll keep the Torah, but not 613. Which ones would Hashem said, sorry, I can't balk on those? You wanna whittle me down? Yeah, Shluch HaKan. Let's say we're not gonna do Shluch HaKan. Shooing away the motherbird. We're not gonna do that. So it'd be 612. And we could have made a deal with him. So maybe he would have said, yeah, okay, 612 then. Which ones though would he say, no? That you have to keep. Without that, there's no point. Shabbos. No. He had a sacrificed Shabbos. Unbelievable, hey? Medrash Rabba, I think I can make this stuff up. Shabbos, he'd let it slide. Honoring your... Oh, he'd let that slide too. He'd let that... Look at these 10. He'd let that slide. Okay, you don't honor your mother and father? Don't honor your mother and father. You've got to keep the others. Kashrus, he wasn't willing to bend on. Kashrus, he wasn't willing to bend on. Why? The Medrash Rabba explains as follows. Kashrus, in and of itself, keeps your body clear. If you've trafed up, if we say, listen, we'll keep everything but kashrus, we'll end up not keeping anything. Because our bodies would be so coarse and insensitive, we'll stray. But he knew, if we keep kosher, everything else will follow suit. He'll get everything else. All 613 will just follow, all 612 will follow in. If you keep kosher, at least your body will be sensitive enough that when you hear and do the right thing, you'll be somewhat tuned in enough, and over a period of time, it'll work its way through. But kashrus ain't negotiable. It's a very interesting thing that Rabbi Aaron Feldman Schlitter, the Rosh Hashiva of Baltimore, used to give a shiur in Mishlei Motzi Shabbos for 26 years. And he once stopped in the middle of the shiur, and it was a shiur to individuals that weren't from birth. And he just stopped and he said, can I ask how many of you here were vegetarian before you started to attend yeshiva? And over 60% put up their hands. And he says, every year he sees the same thing. He tries to ask it once a year with each new group, and every year he sees the same thing. He says, that carefulness you had in Kmart or Tesco's or where you're looking at the back, that brought you to Jerusalem. Says the reason is that you didn't trade yourself up enough. It's a massive schus. A good number of people who are careful about their diet end up more Torah sensitive, and that's something which is honest at all times. It's honest at all times. Periodic observances is number three. This just includes matters that must be observed at specific times, such as Shabbos and Yom Tov. What is the most infrequent periodic observance?
Jubilee.
The Jubilee year, once every 49, 50 years. Nope. Oh, actually, well, Yeah, okay. I guess you got me. I was going to say Birkas HaChama, the blessing of the sun, which is once every 28 years. But the Jubilee year trumps it.
What about the blessing when you see a meteorite?
That's not a periodic observance.
It is. That is every 28 years that
The meters are in between, orbit.
There's no... that's not a periodic observance. It's only circumstantial if you happen to see it. A Birkas HaChama, you've got to do. You've got to do Birkas HaChama. You never see Halley's Comet or Hail Bob, so you never see it. No mitzvah to go and see one. If you happen to see one and it wasn't overcast, then there's no separation to say. But that's the next one. That's circumstantial observances. The fourth one is those which are dependent upon an event and or a situation. Thus, for example, one can fulfill the command of separating the dough offering known as challah, which is a special tithe that must be given from dough or baked products to the Kohen, only when one bakes, and I would add a certain volume of flour, 2.2 kilos with a bracha, 2 kilos without a bracha, of actual flour. If you make a 1 kilo batch, there is no, if you're not allowed to take challah. However, if you store lots of 1 kilo batches together in the same basket, then that comes together to make the necessity to take challah. But that only happens, let's say I never bake, so you never have to take challah. Similarly, Misa, which is a form of tithe as well, can be separated only when one eats produce from the land of Israel. You can't take Misa from potatoes grown in Ireland. It doesn't work. If you have potatoes grown in Israel, you're not allowed to eat them until Truma and Misa has been taken, depending upon which year in the 6 to 7 year cycle you're in. Right, that's why. Likewise, the commandment to redeem one's firstborn son cannot be fulfilled if you don't have. I had a firstborn daughter. So that's it. So Bechor doesn't happen, right? So that's it. Only if and when it happens. Yes, you've got a mitzvah to do it. If it comes along like the comet. But if you don't see it, it doesn't happen. You've got a mitzvah to say, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I've got to marry someone else and have a firstborn son with her. There's no mitzvah for that.
I've got both.
Okay, all four categories of observances are further divided into two general groups. This is really important. So you've got four types of mitzvah, and they are continuous, a fixed number of times a day, or periodic, or circumstantial and occasional. And those four have two subdivisions. One is consisting of what a person must do in order to fulfill the Torah decrees. You've got to do certain things, like eat matzah on the first night of Yom Tov, Pesach. And the other is what he's forbidden to do. There's positive and negative. Dwelling in a sukkah. That's something you're required to do, right, for a man. So, okay, I'm going to dwell in a sukkah, okay? And not eating pork is something I'm required not to do, right? These two groupings are generally referred to as positive versus negative. And that's the pasuk in Tehillim that says, Sumara v'asei tov. Remove yourself from negativity and then go and do the good. First, don't do something bad, then go actively do the good. Now, I remember discussing with those that were here previously that the main chunk of reward that we have is for doing the positive mitzvahs. The positive mitzvahs are more important than negative mitzvahs, because that's really going out your way to do something. Negative mitzvahs is don't trafe up the system. Don't ruin yourself. So if it says don't worship idols, so if an individual does go and worship idols, they make themselves intensely God-insensitive by doing that, which makes it harder for them to do the real hardcore mitzvahs, which are things like sukkah and Pesach and stuff like that, which is when you're busy doing stuff. But the doing of the stuff is the most important stuff. Avoiding the negativity is vital, but it's really there to prevent you from ruining the system so you can do good stuff when you're meant to do it. Is this making any... That not making total sense there. One more time.
Favour doing... not doing negatives than doing positives.
No, the most important mitzvahs we have that come to our hands are the positives.
Right.
They're the most important mitzvahs we've got.
So we should do those before doing negative.
Well, it's not. The point is that their function is different. Mitzvahs, which are the most important mitzvahs we're going to talk about, this meaning of mitzvahs, is really basically the positive mitzvahs. Go do mitzvah X. So I go and I do mitzvah X, and I build something, or I make something,
so
or I do.
So better to collect up positive mitzvahs.
Positive mitzvahs are the biggies. They're the bigger ones. Why then do we have 365 negative mitzvahs? Like, don't do this, don't do that, especially don't do this on that, don't eat that. Why? Because if you do any of the negative mitzvahs, whatever they are, they're going to damage you.
Okay.
They're going to make you more insensitive to do the stuff which is your job. So you know what it's like? Let's say there's a stewardess on a plane, and she's coming round with that little trolley, you know, with coffee and tea. Yeah, oh, a welcome break. You know what I'm saying? One of the most important things that she has to do on a long-haul flight is serve food. People really need, they can't get up. You want them all to sit down and basically stay totally stationary for several hours. And you're going to serve the food and drink and stuff like that. So it's your job as a steward or stewardess to make sure they're comfy in their seat. And one of the things is, give them something to eat. That's a positive mitzvah. One of the things not to do when you're steward is to, dress in the wrong uniform and just really, really smell very badly. Now, there's nothing wrong intrinsically with dressing in the uniform. As long as you give them food, they'll be generally happy. But if you're dressed up as a clown, and you're not meant to be, like with a note and a crazy hair, and it may be like a scary mask, and then, you have a really intense stench or something, people are going to go, that's going to get in the way of what you're really meant to do, which is give them food. So you say, don't wear a clown suit, don't be smelly. And the reason for that is when you do what you're really meant to do, it doesn't get in the way of that. Negative mitzvahs are like landmines getting in the way of you doing what you're really meant to do, which is do something on the other side of that field. Don't step on the landmine, otherwise you're going to get to that field. Do you know what I'm saying? Is that making sense? And that's very, very important when it comes to God consciousness. All mitzvahs are doing is being close to God. Negative mitzvahs will move you away from God. Positive mitzvahs get you closer to God. So don't do the things which move you away from God, and do the things which bring you closer to God. Is that making...
You said negative mitzvahs move you away from God.
Yes.
You mean doing a negative mitzvah.
Doing, being over a negative... Don't eat pork.
Killing somebody.
I will go and now eat pork. Right. That is now taking... That's actively doing something I'm meant not to do. If you've got two, the more important mitzvah is the one which is constant and continuous. Those are very, very heavy duty mitzvahs.
So doing something as a woman, for instance, like you said about taking the challah, that's like the fourth category.
Yes.
So as a woman, are you better to concentrate on maybe finding the time to say Shema every day at the right time?
That's a good question. If a woman lives all of her life and says Shema twice a day, that's more important than the woman who takes challah but doesn't say Shema. However, there's a special thing that women have taken on specifically with challah in order to rectify Chava's misdeed. But that's over in a personal, individual circumstance. If you've got the ability to do one mitzvah and not another, then yes, you should do the continuous ones.
Right.
I'm going to just pause. I forgot that I'd like to give the shiur as a schus for a fool for Kayla Bas Leah and Jacqueline Bas Kayla. Okay? I'm back. Okay, point four. However, the general goal of observances and study was explained earlier. That is, serving God is the way that man becomes directed to God. That's how there's no other way to do it. You can make up local approximations, but it doesn't help. And it draws himself near to God and clings to God through the different kinds of mechanisms which God has given you. There's certain mechanisms in the winter, there's certain mechanisms in the summer, there's certain things in this way, there's certain things in that way, and all are opportunities to draw yourself closer to God. We call those mitzvahs. Highlight, if you have a highlighter and a text and are willing to do that. All the way from here to the end of the paragraph, all the way to little superscript 5. Man must strive to remove every possible obstacle, every element of evil that is associated with his base physical nature and the material world, urging himself in God's direction until he attaches, as it were, to God and partakes of God's perfection. You are literally doing what God would want you to do in that case. This is all that God desires of man, and this is the only reason man was created, as mentioned earlier. Now let's just do that one more time. Man must strive to remove every obstacle, every element of evil that is associated with his base physical nature and the material world, urging him in God's direction. This does not mean we divorce ourselves from the material world. We're not that kind of religion. We don't do that. Okay? In Matthew, I can't believe I'm quoting Matthew here, but in Matthew, it states that it is better for men to castrate themselves. And unfortunately, based upon a time that most men aren't on the level to castrate themselves, then we'll allow them to marry a woman. If you have to. We don't do that. We say, I'm physical, I'm involved in the physical world. The physical world is a tool for me to get closer to Hashem with whatever it is I'm using, be it textiles or metals or any form of material or wealth, and I will use it in order to get to a tool, to, as a springboard to get close to Hashem. What we don't do, though, is immerse ourselves in the physical and get more physicality purely for the sake of physicality. The expression of that is Yavam, is Greece, and the secular culture in which we now live, where physicality is a thing to desire, obtain, and aspire to in and of itself. Now, you could say, listen, I want physicality in order to be able to do mitzvahs. That's a good reason to strive to physicality. I want a big house because I want to open up my house to lots and lots of people. I plan to do that. I simply don't have the space. I want a bigger car because I want to give more people lifts. I want more money so that I can do properly the mitzvahs in a better way, because some mitzvahs are very expensive, such as Pesach. Pesach is a very expensive mitzvah, right? And that costs. I want a sukkah, and I need the money. One of the tefillahs that we daven for, there's a special tefillah that you can put in Shemona Esrei to daven for wealth. And one of the things that we daven for in the wealth is that we're able to keep mitzvahs with the wealth that we've got. I.e. we use the money in order to be able to serve Hashem. So it isn't as if we divorce Chas Shalom, say, now I must be penniless, and I must live in a commune, and I must only have one set of clothing. That's not the goal. If you're put into a situation where you can't learn Torah except for that, then you should be willing to go down to that level of deprivation. That's what Pirkei Avos explains. You know, you want to sleep on a bed made of nails and just drink, you know, a bit of water and bread with salt. If it has to get that bad, Rashi explains, you should be willing to do that. But that's not the ultimate, because such an individual is going to be able to do very many mitzvahs. And he's certainly not going to do mitzvahs with hida, with splendor, which is something we're required to do. Point five. The details and mechanics of these matters involve the very structure of the world and mankind. Because the world and how it works is a framework for mitzvahs. And all the varying attributes of each, man and the world. For these observances, the mitzvahs are given to man so that he can perfect himself and perfect all of creation at the same time. Its entire structure and every component, root and branch, every single thing you do in a mitzvah affects every single thing in the world. So basically, looking at the four world chart again, we've got a top-down, bottom-up system. We've got a deterministic and an indeterministic flow. When John decides to do a mitzvah, that strengthens the koichas. That strengthens the primordial forces for those individuals that were in earlier parts. And then that, of course, is going to have a better flow back down. Everything is functioning on that. Let's continue to the beginning of page 255. We said previously, you can't observe without study, and you can't study without observances. Well, if you can study, but you don't keep it, you don't know what we're talking about. If you've never seen a lulav, and there's one down the street, the question is, why didn't you go get one? I remember I was in the Beis HaMedrash, and there was a particular time where a particular mitzvah came up, and I went out to Rav Chaim Daval Tusky, who was the Chiddushei Basra, Zechot Tzadeh Livracha, unbelievable time, son-in-law of Rav Scheinberg. And he said, you know, there are certain times where it comes where you have to close the sefer in the Beis HaMedrash. He was an individual that had more Siddurim than any other person you could meet. He had like 50 Siddurim a day. Some only for 5 minutes. But he kept those Siddurim for 50 years. He said to me, sometimes you have to close the sefer and go do the mitzvah. Now comes the time to do the mitzvah. So close the sefer, go do the mitzvah. So if it's time for Sukkos, and everyone's rushing out to buy their Arba Minim, their Lulav and Esrog, and you're sitting in the basement and you're going, I'll just study about it. That's not good enough. Yes, it's something, but it ain't as good as doing it. Now's the time to shut the book that you've been learning about Arba Minim. Go and buy yourself some fruit and veg. Get yourself a stick and a lemon. That has to be done. So you've got to shut the book at that particular point in time. Now, yes, we have said previously that if you don't have the opportunity to do a mitzvah, that learning about the mitzvah is at least tapping into the content of the mitzvah, which is what we said earlier today, that if we can't do the korbanos, at least we learn about the korbanos. But if you've got the opportunity to learn about a korban, or give a korban in its correct time and its correct way, then how are you going to give it? So when mitzvahs come to hand, do them. Now, you may turn around and say, but I'm not going to do it as well if I haven't learned about it. That's true. But because most mitzvahs are periodic, We expect that as the years go by of your mitzvah observance, you get better and better at it, more learned, and a greater depth of understanding. Just like an individual may learn Chumash once, and they learn it with Rashi, then maybe they learn it with Ramban, then they learn it with the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, then they start to see more and more. By the time they've done 10, 15 times around the Chumash, that's a different book. It's just not the same Chumash that you learned, you know, in the beginning, right? This is not the same thing. So too, the first time you waved Arminim, let's say you were 13 and you waved Arminim, you're like, wow, okay, I'm doing everything what everyone's doing. When you're 60 and you've been learning about Arminim, let's say for, I don't know, 50 years prior, that Arminim you're waving there is a much, much better mitzvah. So there's study and observance, so both are required. Of course, you can't observe without study. You're going to have to learn what the mitzvah is. Indeed, the Chacham, around the table of the Pesach Seder, he's the one's asking the details of the laws. He's saying, what's details of the laws? That's a Chacham. A Chacham is saying, right, now that I know what I've got to do, but what's the Gedorim? What's the beginning and end point of each mitzvah? You can't learn without doing, you can't do without. They're both together deeply entwined with each other. Now, obviously, because of this, the study of Torah, which is the motherboard, it's the blueprint, it's where all mitzvahs sit as resistors and capacitors and components on the grid of a framework, clearly the study of Torah is an absolutely necessary matter. Because without it, you can never do what the Torah is telling you. You won't know what the Torah is telling you. Because if a person doesn't know...
Just clarify. What you're actually talking about here is stimulating Shefa, the forces, the interaction between man and the spiritual world, the physicality and spirituality. So you're saying that there's different strengths of stimulation?
Yes.
That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes. So Torah study in its own right is an end in and of itself. Don't think, look, the Torah is only a manual and really using the washing machine is really what it's about. There's no mitzvah to read a washing machine manual. There's a mitzvah to have clean clothing. So the only reason I'm reading the manual is to get the washing machine working so I can get my clean clothing, and really the clean clothing is a mitzvah. No, it's different here. Here, the washing machine mitzvah is only given place because what the manual says. You see the difference? The manual doesn't just talk about washing machines. It talks about cookers and tumble dryers and microwaves and cars and everything. And it says when to do it, how to do it, in what way, and at what time. It's not just about the washing machine. Because the study of Torah in and of itself plays a very large role in bringing man to perfection. Let's elaborate on this. Let's talk about this. How can just learning some text do that? Of all the influences, Ronnie, that God causes to emanate from him for the sake of his creations, one influence is more intense and higher than all the others, being more dear and more precious than anything else that God created. This influence is the closest thing to God himself that can be found anywhere in creation. Its loftiness and excellence resembling God's own to some degree. Through this particular influence, God enables creations to actually partake of some of his own glory and perfection, as it were.
I turn the page too slowly.
This influence, however, was bound by God to yet another creation, and that is the Torah, which God designed specifically to carry this influence into the physical world. If you want to make a shoulder note, I've written here, the Torah is a vector for God's influence. The Torah acts as a vector, a method of transmission for God's influence. In practice, the influence arrives by two activities, namely the speaking and understanding the words of Torah. This is awesome. I want to talk about medical pharmacology for a moment. Some drugs are termed prodrugs. You may have heard this term, a prodrug. What is a prodrug?
Well,
that's a, this is an amazing design. A prodrug is a drug that really, if you look at it, is not the medicine you need. It's not what's going to do it for you. But when you take it, your body will metabolize, break down and change that drug in the liver into the drug you need. The great thing about a prodrug is I can give a very little bit of the prodrug, and because the body is going to make its own metabolizing function of that drug and make lots and lots and lots of the actual, like break it down, and that breakdown will be the target component to what we need to give you, then it's a very potent drug. I can give you a little bit of that. It'll stimulate a whole chain reaction, and you yourself will make the thing that it's going to heal you yourself. Do you hear what I'm saying? The Tyra is both a medicine in and of itself, and it's a prodrug. Let me just explain that, because that's like a bit, whoa. Here's number one. The Tyra in and of itself is a medicine that when you take it, even without understanding it or anything, it just works like a paracetamol. I've got a headache, and I take a paracetamol. I don't understand how it worked, but it worked, and my headache went away. Very good. On top of that, the Tyra is a prodrug. As the Tyra breaks down, as it were, in your body, in your psyche, as it works through your mind, it gives you a further medicine of being able to understand more Tyra. That's the level of understanding and comprehension above pure recitation. Pure recitation does one thing. It does something because of the vector. You're basically reciting a code which works. Look, if you've got a guy who knows computer code and he's reading it out to someone else and all he has to do says 1100, he goes 1101. If it's the right thing, it works right. It functions and the computer does stuff. How does it work? I don't know. Ask the programmers. I don't know. That's machine code, man. That's really deep. I don't know how one's binary. It's too deep. But there are other individuals that when they're reading it, they really know what's going on. They go, if those ones are doing that, maybe Tucker, when the next one's got, I understand, doesn't mean to do that as well. Both things are happening. So let's see that in the words again. The influence arrives by means of two activities. Number one, speaking. And number two, understanding words of the Torah. As mentioned previously, God chose a particular combination of words and sayings to constitute the Torah, which consists of five books. On a lower level, the prophets, Nevi'im, and then the writings, Kesuvim, making the 24 books of the Bible. God then bound the aforementioned influence to the words of these books in such a way that when a person actually pronounces the words of Tyre, the influence is transmitted to him. This is one of the reasons we are so careful not to talk during Kriya Satara. It's not just for Derech Eretz. It's not just for respect. Listen to this. I said earlier, right, there's a guy who doesn't know a computer program, and he's telling another guy, 11001110. So the people that don't know how to do, so they're going, one, they're pressing 1001. There's only two buttons, a one and a zero, right? And they just have to do that exactly right. Well, you'd better hear what the guy's telling you then. Because one incorrect data entry of either a one or a zero, and you've ruined the code. It's not going to work, right? That's why we're so careful for every single letter in the Torah. If a guy's reading it, look, could you imagine a guy read Shakespeare? Lahavdil. A guy has a Shakespeare recital evening, and he starts citing it, and I know he makes a slight pronunciation mistake on a word. You're going to shout at him from the stalls? You're going to go, oh, I think that word was hobnob. You know, Shakespeare invented the words hobnob. Hobnob, he invented that term. He just made it up. So he says the word hobnob, and someone goes, no, you can't say that. That's not a word in English. You go, oh, for goodness sake, I'm inventing this. Atunia Genesis, I'm making this up. Okay, but you missed it. So he said something, he didn't get it. Okay. Well, the Torah can't work like that. The Torah is the program code. If one letter, even a vowel, is out, which changes its meaning, we scream at the guy and tell him to say it again.
There's no liquid dots in the...
Because there's a half is given over, half isn't. We'll get to that. He's given us the letters and the order, and then we were entrusted with the vowelization and the sing song, the trop. So half was rebottom, half was derisa. He gave that over orally and written. So we've got to be very careful to say it correctly. Right? Indeed. The land of Israel is called what? The land flowing with?
Milk and honey.
How do you know that?
Because
The Torah doesn't say milk and honey. The Torah's got the letters. How do you know it's not chaylev udvash? Suet and honey. The land flowing with lard and honey. Right, the oral tradition says you should pronounce it chalev with a straight line under the ches, a patach, instead of a tserei, a chaylev. If you say chaylev udvash, it's a land flowing with suet and honey. Same letters. Same letters. But yet the Gentiles are very fully aware that Israel is land flowing with milk and honey. Not that they believe in the wicked Pharisees, i.e. the Rabbonim, who actually tell you how to read the Torah, because they wouldn't allow Yoshki to get married, because he was a mumzer. So therefore, what we're going to say is like this. Chalev v'chalev, who's to say? The point is, that's the data that's coming through. So someone talks, and then someone's going to transmit, saying the land flowing with suet mani. Because someone was talking. If that comes across in the data pool, then God's influence is also malformed and it's going to ruin you. That's why we're so careful in the data transmission. That's why we're all listening very carefully. That's why we're told every week, listen to the Torah. That's why we're told every Shabbos, listen to the Torah. Every Yom Tov, listen. Why is Kriyas HaTorah so key? Because it's you've got to get the 101110. Because you don't get it exactly right. If even a word comes through wrong, or if you don't hear it in a repetition way, you're going to muck up with it. And if you're going to muck up with it, it'll ruin you. It'll become worthless. Because what it'll do is actually malform God's manifestation and give you the wrong impression on the wrong end of the stick. We can't have that. That's the concept of no talking during Kriyas HaTorah. Because you've got to hear the data code correctly. Yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem. It's a problem. That's why Kriyas HaTorah has to be said over clearly. You've got to hear it. Now, part of the reason why the public talks through today is because they don't understand what it's saying when it's actually written out. It might just be relating tight, you know, in Thai or Korean. Yeah. It's like blah 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 blah. It just doesn't mean anything anymore. Mm. We're in a golos where the Torah doesn't mean anything to the Jews. Could you just saying those words is just ridiculous. That's like an anathema. That's the same way mathematics doesn't mean anything to the mathematicians. Or medicine doesn't mean anything to the doctors. That's bonkers. You're the people that are meant to know about it, right? The Jews are the people who are meant to know what the Torah says. I mean, everyone knows that. And yet the Jews, unfortunately, when you read the Torah, don't know what is potting. That's part of the problem. That is because of a break in the chain of study. A break in the chain of study leads to that. That's why you've got to know it. If you listen more, you're more likely to reattach yourself to the chain of study and understand what exactly the resonance is. But that's why there's talking. More distance from God, by the way, leads to more distance of God. Avera gereres avera. An avera drags another avera in its wake. A mitzvah drags another mitzvah in its wake. So the more you listen, if a guy says, listen, I really want to hear this, he's going to be the kind of person that's going to want to hear more. The more he hears, the more he learns, the more he learns, the more he knows, the more he does, the more he hears, the more he learns again. And it becomes a positive feedback cycle, right? While the person, the more that talks, the more doesn't do, then the more he walks off, the more he walks off, the more he wouldn't even turn up to hear. When he does hear, the more he talks, and he becomes so distant, three generations later, they don't know the Shema. That's how it works. It's a system. That's why it says the influence is going to be transmitted on the pronunciation. It is therefore the concept of involvement in the Torah. The simple recitation of these books, Torah Nevi'im Mikasuvim, the Torah, the prophets, and the writings, can have a great effect if done under conditions that we must discuss later. They don't always work, and sometimes it's better not to learn them, shockingly. The same is true of comprehension. Through the content of these words' meaning, this influence is transmitted to the one who comprehends them. But by the way, I'm sorry, there is, for the tape, Orach Chaim, which is the first chalik of the Shulchan Aruch, Simon, section Resh Pei Hei 285, says in Ois Gimel, in the Halacha, and in Zion, in the Mishnah Berurah, that there's a concept of Shnei Mikra Ve'echad Targum. You should read the entire Torah twice in Hebrew, and once with an authoritative translation, every single week of your life. Why would that mitzvah be a mitzvah? I have to read the entire Torah twice in Hebrew. By the way, if you can't read it in Hebrew, you can get away with it with saying it along with a Baal Kaira. So the Balkara is reading. If you say every word with him, his reading counts for one, and your miming with him counts for another. Which is why, by the way, when you get an Aliyah at the Tyra, and he's reading, really it's meant to be you that's reading. Indeed, in some shuls it is. Be careful about that. Some Sephardi shuls, I give you an Aliyah, you're reading. Everyone will be like, go for it. So people are like, what do you mean? Like, no, this is how we do it. Now, today that most people can't read, we have a reader who will read for those that can't read. So he reads for everyone, whether you can or can't read. But the person who's the Ayla should mutter along the words, which is why he's got a yad to point so you can see where he's at. So you can say the words too, because it's meant to be you that's reading. You're making the bracha on the recitation. You've got to read it. If you can read it with him, you read it in an undertone. I have seen some people say, please may I read. But in Sephardi shul, I remember I went to a Sephardi shul in Stamford Hill. You get an Aliyah there, you laning, there's no Bakara. So I remember someone was walking up to the person sitting next to me saying, what's your name? And the guy next to him nudged him and said, you get an Aliyah, you're laning. He said, forget it. Call someone. I was like, oh my gosh, is that what they do here? It's like, yeah, you get an Aliyah there, you're reading, finished. You know, that's where it's meant to be. You know? Now, not in all Sephardi shuls.
So that's it.
So now, yeah, and you have a vada, the covered, a vada. You pay for covered. So it's like this, you give to the Torah. Just like this. So it's why Shnei Mukhav Echatagam? Why should I have to read it twice in Hebrew and once with an authoritative translation every week? Why would that mitzvah be encoded? Why don't you tell me the answer to that? Why? What's the point of all this? Why be something twice in Hebrew and once in authoritative translation? Why do I need that much?
Code imprinted into your memory of the computer, which is your body, and the body can't work properly because it can't follow the code.
Excellent. If this is the influence by which you're going to get anything, well, you better get some influence. That's why we've got Shnei Mukhav Echatagam. Jay's witness is knocked on my door. Open up the door. Fantastic fun. I love it. That's brilliant. Isn't the world full of sorrow? Yes, it is. I love the way they start. Don't we need a Messiah? Oh, absolutely, we do. Well, I've got good news for you, sir. What's that? The Messiah has come. Oh, what a terrible job he must have done. Why? Isn't it brilliant? No, it's terrible. So I turn around and I say, do you put these on? And they say, no. I say to the mezuzah, do you have a mezuzah? No. Do you dwell in a booth? No. I go through as many as I can. And then obviously they keep saying, no, 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 no. And I say, but you do agree in the Old Testament. And they say, yes. And then I say, but why don't you do it then? And they say, because it's been replaced. But I say, in Deuteronomy, it says you can't take away or add to it. And they say, oh, I've never got a decent answer for that. Never got a decent answer for that. It says in Deuteronomy, Baal Tosef, you can't take away your answer. Now, I then say, have you read the Old Testament? I've never had one of them say they have. They're quite truthful when they speak, they say, no, I haven't read. So you're coming to me to tell me about what the Old Testament is, and you haven't read it, and I'm commanded to read it three times a year, twice in original Hebrew, one with an authoritative translation. And you're telling me what the Old Testament says? You were knocking on the wrong door. How can you? Now, how can I say? I can only say that because I've read the thing. I can only say I've read the thing because I'm told to read it twice a week, once with the translation, every single week. I've got an app on my phone with the English and the Hebrew and English with Rashi and translation. I can do Shnei Mukhav Echatagam on my phone. Gevaldik! But you've got to know the data. If you don't know the data, how can you be rogil with it? That's why Shnei Mukhav Echatagam is encoded. That's why the Shulchan Aruch brings it in. Just as in the case of all other influences and concepts in creation, this influence of Torah has many degrees. It's not just once you get it, you get it, you get it. Okay, fine, I got it. I read it once. Finished. I shut the book. And, you know, it was a good book and it was very interesting. Thorough book, interesting book, and now I've closed the book and finished. Simchas Torah, you've got to start the whole thing again. When you get to Chasan Torah, it's Chasan Bereishis, right? We don't stop and say, well, you know, the Eitzot says they finish the Torah, but they're going to start. Immediately we start again. Just as soon as we finish the Devarim, back at the beginning. Why? because the effects of both the recitation and comprehension are differentiated as deemed proper by highest wisdom. Each different recitation transmits a particular degree of this influence. One particular parsha talks about certain ideas, and another parsha talks about other ideas, and the influences and intensity of the transmission differs based upon topic, based upon the letter code order. Each different recitation therefore transmits a particular degree of this influence. The same is also true of comprehension. There's basic level of comprehension, there's advanced comprehension, then there's the understanding the allusion meanings, then the understanding the ethical moral approaches, there's the understanding of the esoteric readings, all within the same code text.
What does comprehension mean?
Basic comprehension is pshat. Understanding pshat. Sometimes the Torah will talk in ways which you're not meant to understand as pshat. For instance, if I say I have a frog in my throat, that would be correctly by the Oxford University Press translated as there's an amphibian stuck in my neck. That is absolutely accurate. A frog, because in some, what is a frog? We're not sure it's a frog. Someone said it's a frog. Someone said it's a lizard. Someone said it's an alligator, both in the Old English. And therefore we do know, though, it's an amphibian. And a throat, it could be a throat. It could be that it could be the nape of the neck. We're going to say for sure it means neck. So after the years of doing it, we'll say absolutely with all abstinence that there is an amphibian in the neck. And that's what it means. Those are the words translated correctly. But that's not the meaning. The meaning is the guy's got a sore throat. Yes, the words say there's an amphibian in his neck, but the meaning is he's got a sore throat. You've got to know in the translation when Rashi's telling you, when the Mefarshim say, well, this is to be taken absolutely as read, and that's to be taken nowhere near as read. And if you read it as read, you're wrong. That's called pshat, that's basic comprehension. Understanding what the Torah is telling you. There is no element of Torah study, however, that does not transmit some degree of the highest influence, as long as the necessary, add in the words, prerequisite conditions are fulfilled, which we'll get to, please God, next time. This was, I hope, a good introduction to the concepts of mitzvah performance, how they're going to work, how we're going to see that they're basically influence transmitters, as Ronnie was talking about. Some more intense than others. This is the concept of some mitzvahs being bigger than others, i.e. their resonances, their influences are more potent than others. While some averas are bigger than others, which means the negative resonances and influences are more potent than others. Certain averas are very, very intensely negative, while certain averas are bad, but they won't destroy the world kind of thing. Certain mitzvahs are extremely potent and have tremendously wide spiritual influences, and certain mitzvahs aren't as potent. They give you, they're good, they're very, very nice, but they aren't like absolutely core essence mitzvahs. What they're doing basically is turning you in God's perspective, in God's direction in each. Now, obviously there's a pattern. You want the little resistors and the big capacitors to point that really all mitzvahs don't really have any intrinsic value without all of them are the whole. Because like one motherboard with one resistor, a teeny worthless resistor off of it is useless. You need everything there. So you can't really say one mitzvah. Yes, individually, this is a very expensive capacitor and this is a very, very, very cheap resistor. But the truth is I need both perfectly placed because the whole electrical flow has to be perfect. So really all mitzvahs also have a supernal value, which is how they work together. Which means if you don't keep Pesach, but you keep Shavuos and Sukkos, you're missing something in that Shavuos and Sukkos without that other Yom Tov. That makes sense, right? Yom Tov isn't Yom Tov. There's three Yom Tovim. There's three foot festivals, right? You say, listen, I'll do one. I'll do Shavuos, I'll have cheesecake, stay up all night, but I will not dwell in a sukkah, and I will not eat flatbreads in the spring. Well, then the Shavuos, remember, Shavuos is the end of Pesach. We've been counting 49 days from Pesach. So Shavuos is actually the culmination of Pesach. Shavuos is just the end of Pesach. And indeed, the korbanos given on Shavuos were loaves of leaven. Big challahs. That's what was given in the temple. Because you've worked for 49 days with the sphere, and now you can actually use leaven correctly. You couldn't use leaven correctly without a good Pesach to know what leaven isn't. So you have to know what leaven isn't before you can give leaven properly. So you say, listen, I'll just keep Shavuos. But without Pesach, what is Shavuos? That's crazy. And without Shavuos, what's Pesach? have all this thing of mavatling, of nullifying all my leaven, and then I can't even get to use the leaven properly in Shavuos. The concept's, it's just, you're missing something. So yes, certain mitzvahs are bigger. You want to say Pesach is a bigger mitzvah because more goes into it. Yes, there's more deraisa mitzvahs involved in Pesach. Positive deraisa mitzvahs. Big deraisa mitzvahs. Eating of the matzah. It's a bigger mitzvah than Shavuos. But without Shavuos, what's the point of Pesach? It's only there for each other. They're connected to each other through Sfira. It's one idea. Pesach and Shavuos is one concept. So if you say I'm only going to do one, you say which one's more intrinsically important? Pesach. Okay, I'll give it to you. But what? But that's like saying which is more important, your memory or your hard drive? Yes, you're right. The hard drive keeps everything in the memory. What's the point? You need both. What's more important, the actual dial of the watch or the strap? Well, obviously the dial's more important, but if I can't wear it and I can't read the time, you're right, the strap is worthless, the watch is the thing with the hands on that actually measures time. But if I can't have it readily available on my wrist where I need to see it, and I have to like fumble about in my pocket, and I can't see it because it's in the dark and there's no... Then what's the point? The point is we need them all. But yes, intrinsically you can argue that some are bigger than others. True. What they do for you has different effects. Different parshas may be more important than others, you may feel. But the truth is, without every other parsha, another parsha has place. If I say, listen, you know, the whole thing with to do with Vikra, the building of the Mishkan, I don't know what's going on there, let's take that out. How are you going to keep Shabbos? We only know how to keep Shabbos because of the tabernacle. So you say, but listen, we don't have a tabernacle anymore. And it was only temporary anyway, and then it was replaced with the base of Mikdash. We don't even have a base of Mikdash. So let's just talk about Bereishis and Devarim. And we'll skip the middle bits. Well, okay, I get that. I hear that, you know, where we come from, very, very nice. But without, you know, Shemois for Yikra and Bamidbar in the middle, Bereishis and Devarim don't really make intrinsic sense. You've got to have a continuum. So different parshas have different influences. Different mitzvahs have different resonances. But this all comes together to make one holistic overall mental change in you, the practitioner. And that's vital to understand. Because the mitzvah I'm doing now is this mitzvah. But that mitzvah has another place in the whole scheme of things. The truth is, when you're munching on matzah on the first night of Pesach, you should have in mind, I'm fulfilling the scriptural mitzvah to munch matzah on this night. But it's also helping me understand Shavuos and allowing me to be a more understanding Jew. If you don't have matzah, you're going to miss out a huge swathe of the answer. You can't, if you don't have matzah, first night Pesach, you're missing a lot. You're not just missing that night. You're not part of the whole thing. There's millions and millions of Jews all over the world that night all munching matzah. All over the world. And some are on holiday in Luzerne and in Nice and in Israel and in America. But they're all munching matzah, talking about the same thing with the same book. Because you're part of a continuum. Missing that isn't just missing that event. You're missing a vital membership to a fraternity. And without a membership to that fraternity, you're missing all the perk and fringe benefits that come along with that. It's not. There's nothing standalone. You're right, there's nothing truly standalone, but everything we're going to look at in a standalone way, so we can understand what's going on. The only thing which is totally, truly global is limited Torah, because that touches on absolutely everything. Please God, we'll talk about the conditions we must learn Torah next time. It's wonderful to see you.